You're listening to episode 105 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers, we are back from hiatus. How are you? We're so happy to be back. And before we get started, a very warm welcome to our new 88 Cups of Tea listeners. As a quick overview of our podcast, I interview really inspiring and awesome storytellers in hopes that their personal experiences and advice will empower you and make you feel less alone in your storytelling journey. For all of my listeners who've been with us for a while, thank you so much for hanging out with us every week. You are wonderful. And a massive hug to our listeners who recommended and shared our podcast with friends and took the time to leave us iTunes ratings and reviews. Here's a recent one that I'd love to share with you. Many thanks to Brandon Arrett for leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. He wrote, "Fun, inspirational, and educational. I'm thoroughly impressed with this podcast. It isn't dry like you may think interviews would be. Extremely entertaining and informative. I love hearing how all these authors that I love approach the initial part of their novels. Keep it up." Thanks so much for taking the time to leave us a rating and a review, Brandon. That was really awesome, and I so appreciate you. Now on to the rest of our intro. If you're looking for a sense of family with a bunch of people who understand the highs and lows of being a writer, you should seriously check out our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I love this community of ours, and I always have the best time with them. We check in almost every day to talk about our work in progress, our latest achievements, current reads, and so much more. Truly, honestly, we have the most encouraging and supportive members in our group, so you don't want to miss out on this special community. Come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. In today's new episode, we have Nick Stone, author of the incredibly powerful debut, Dear Martin. Her new novel releases on October 17, and I am beyond excited that we can reveal an excerpt from Dear Martin that's exclusive to our 88 Cups of Tea community. To read the exclusive excerpt, head over to Nick's show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Nick-Stone, or you can also check out the summary for this episode in your podcast player and click on the link that'll take you directly to Nick's show notes page. In our conversation today, you'll learn what inspired the idea for Nick's debut, Dear Martin, and what helped to shape the voice of her main character, Justice McAllister. She shares how to create emotional resonance in our work by being vulnerable and writing like a reader. We discuss the importance of having an honest and visionary editor on our team, the importance of diverse representation in the publishing industry, and how playing with the format of your book can help you cater to specific audiences. Further into our conversation, we talk about the detrimental problems caused by systemic racism, and we deep dive into understanding that the root of anger can lead to compassion, and how to create change through self-reflection. We wrap up the interview chatting about Nick's next novel that she is currently working on, and you really don't want to miss out on it. So let's jump right in. Hey everyone, we have Nick Stone with us today from her book, Dear Martin. I am so excited to have Nick on the show. Nick, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am so good. I shared with Nick, as you all know, I am a really slow reader. I like to nitpick every sentence and everything, so it slows me down by times 10. What would normally take someone, I don't know, a month to read, I might take 3 to 6 months, so it's pretty bad. My girlfriend Moonlin is the co-producer on the show. She read Nick's book, Dear Martin, in 1 hour. She had to stop in the middle and took a break, went to the freezer in the kitchen and grabbed her frozen Frappuccino from Starbucks to literally cool herself down, and then went back to read. So I was like, wait, what the hell is going on? She usually is my human spark notes. Even though I knew everything that was going to happen to the characters and the plot, I still jumped into Nick's book and I read it from start to finish in 3 hours. It was a complete page turner and I could not stop, and I was still emotionally impacted even though I knew everything that was going to happen. So kudos to you, Nick. Thank you for having this book out there, for creating this and putting it in our hands soon. When listeners hear this, it's before your book releases. I'm so happy to have you on the show. Okay, I'll shut up now.
Thank you. No, this is great. Like, of course, this is what every author wants to hear. So if you would like to keep going, I'm not going to stop you.
I'm so honored to have you on the show. I'm so excited. I was up at 3 a.m. this morning because I was excited, and then woke up super early again because I'm so excited. Nick, why don't we kick it off and start off with a snapshot, since I keep talking about Dear Martin.
Yeah, sure. So Dear Martin, it follows a 17-year-old African-American boy. There's a night where he's racially profiled by a police officer. And in response to this incident, he decides that he's going to start this journal of letters to Dr. King, working through his movements in the world and trying to process things as he experiences them, and asking himself, like, what would Martin do? And then writing down his experiences as he tries to live his life the way he thinks Martin would. For me, honestly, the book was me exploring the question, what would Martin do in light of America right now, let's be honest. And even America 2 or 3 years ago, you know, every time a kid's name would become a hashtag, yeah, it would hit me in my gut because I have two little boys myself. I've got a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old. And so I decided to try and explore what Martin would do because I kept seeing people quoting Dr. King in opposition to protest movements. Something was off about that. That's really where the book came from, and that's what it's about.
Thank you for that. I'm going to rewind this a little bit because I want listeners to learn more about you. You actually started writing pretty recently.
I started writing in 2013. So yeah, a little over 4 years. It was like March or April.
And then you just gave birth to this book as well, in addition to two sons, which is amazing. And by the way, your sons are so cute. I don't mean to sound like
Thank
a creepy
you.
On your Instagram, but they're so cute and they're gonna be so handsome. You better watch it.
Please creep on my Instagram. That's why I'm there.
So you started writing about 4 years ago, and was that when you first fell in love with writing, or were you in love with writing like way before that?
I have always loved reading. I've loved books for as long as, like, I remember being 5 and 6 and spending hours and hours in the library. But I didn't think I could write fiction. And it was largely because I didn't see people who looked like me writing the kind of fiction I like to read. So, you know, you had your Alice Walker, you had your Toni Morrison, Ellison, like you have all of these big, massive African-American literary writers. But when I would read their work, and I was like 14 and 15, it wasn't, Beloved is an amazing book and I appreciate it as an adult, but trying to read it as a teenager, it wasn't what I was looking for, I'll put it like that. Because that's what I had from people who looked like me, I didn't think that I could write the stuff that I enjoyed reading, which was Gossip Girl, if we're being honest. I loved Gossip Girl. I loved, my favorite book of all times is Jeff Eugenides' The Virgin Suicides. I read that book when I was 16, I think. I'm sure he would probably roll his eyes, but like, it's totally a YA novel. It is probably the epitome of a YA novel. You have these teenagers looking at other teenagers and kind of telling their teenage story. And that's the kind of stuff that I liked to read, but I didn't see people like me writing it, so I didn't think I could write it. What changed? I lived in Israel for a few years. My husband is an Israeli national. And it's funny, earlier you were talking about the Jewish mom. Like, I actually have one of those.
That's yes, amazing.
My mother-in-law.
I grew up in Long Island. Majority are Jewish people. And they always say I'm an honorary Jew. They're like, Yin, you're absolutely one of us. And you're probably going to be a Jewish mom. Israeli people are beautiful.
Who are you telling? very much aware, trust me.
Hence why your sons are so stunning. You better watch it.
Please creep on my Instagram. That's why I swear.
So you started writing about 4 years ago. And was that when you first fell in love with writing, or were you in love with writing like way before that?
My story's a little weird. I have always loved reading. I've loved books for as long as, like, I remember being 5 and 6 and spending hours and hours in the library. But I didn't think I could write fiction. And it was largely because, like, I didn't see people who looked like me writing the kind of fiction I like to read. So, you know, you had your Alice Walker, you had your Toni Morrison, Ellison, like, you have all of these big, massive African-American literary writers, but when I would read their work, and I was like 14 and 15, it wasn't, Beloved is an amazing book and I appreciate it as an adult, but like trying to read it as a teenager, it wasn't what I was looking for, I'll put it like that. Because that's what I had from people who looked like me, I didn't think that I could write the stuff that I enjoyed reading, which was Gossip Girl, if we're being honest. I loved Gossip Girl. I loved, my favorite book of all times is Jeff Eugenides' The Virgin Suicides. I read that book when I was 16, I think. I'm sure he would probably roll his eyes, but like, it's totally a YA novel. It is probably the epitome of a YA novel. You have these teenagers looking at other teenagers and kind of telling their teenage story. And that's the kind of stuff that I liked to read, but I didn't see people like me writing it, so I didn't think I could write it. What changed? I lived in Israel for a few years. My husband is an Israeli national. And it's funny, earlier you were talking about the Jewish mom. Like, I actually have one of those.
That's amazing.
My mother-in-law.
I grew up in Long Island, and my town is known, majority are Jewish people. And they always say I'm an honorary Jew. They're like, Yin, you're absolutely one of us, and you're probably going to be a Jewish mom. So I'm just like, amazing. Oh my God. And I'll tell you, Israeli people are beautiful.
Who are you telling? very much aware, trust me.
Hence why your sons are so stunning.
Hey. We were in Israel and we were coming back to America. Well, I was, because my husband had never actually lived here. I basically plucked him out of his motherland and
you're coming home
with me to America. But while, when I got here, I needed something to do because I came to go back to school, but I had the 6 month, was it 9 months, this like 9 month window when I was just here and a mom, and I needed something to do. At that point, I had just read the first two Divergent books. I had read the entire Hunger Games series, and I was obsessed with John Green books. I'm still obsessed with John Green books.
Listen, it's made me cry, okay? So I totally get it.
I cannot wait for Turtles, by the way. I decided I wanted to try and write a young adult novel because that's kind of where my heart was. And it's what I like to read. And I just needed something to do. So I sat down and I wrote one. And it was hot garbage, by the way. Like, it was so, so bad. But everybody needs that first really terrible novel. It's like the breaking out of the shell. You're hatching and it's messy. There's chips of shell all over the place. But it's cool because then once you're out of it, you can try again and you do something different and it's better.
You're conditioning your muscle, and I totally believe in that.
Yeah, so that's when I got started. That was 2013. And then 2014, I wrote a different novel because my agent at that point, because I'm on my second agent, my first agent, she couldn't get anybody to bite on that first novel because it was terrible, honestly. So I wrote something new, got a new agent, and we went out with that. The first editor to respond, she loved my style and my writing and my prose, but she wasn't really sold on the story. She asked if I was working on anything else, and I had 12 hours to pull together a proposal for Dear Martin. It was 13 pages. It was a synopsis and two sample chapters, and she bought it.
What? Are you serious?
Yeah.
Jeez, yeah. Oh, very belated congratulations on that. That's very, very impressive. Holy crap, you literally just pulled all of that out. That is mastery right there. Did you have training with writing or workshops? It just sounds like you were self-taught.
Yeah, pretty much. You'd be surprised at how much you pick up on if you read a lot. I find that people don't consider how much they're learning about writing just by reading. I know people who speed read, but I don't like to speed read because the whole point of speed reading is turning off. There's this thing called sub-vocalization, right? It's that voice you hear in your head when you're reading. I don't like to turn that off. Hearing that voice in my head helps me figure out how to put it back onto the page when it's time for me to write.
Hence why I'm also really slow.
That's it. You know, just no reading so much, I think, is really what taught me how to write.
So many of us, even me, I read a lot. Probably not as much as you, though. I feel it would be so nice for me personally to have some guidance and be in a workshop or take classes, which I have, because I just find that structure to be so much more helpful. And also the discipline, to be honest.
Yeah.
I do want to rope it back to when you wrote Dear Martin 4 years ago, so you already had your first son. It is mind-boggling to me where you just produce this amazing, incredible book on top of raising a newborn child. There's so much stimulus and so much going on right now. I don't think I can focus. I wish I had that same ounce of discipline that you have, balancing your family at the same time. Was that difficult for you, or was it exciting and invigorating just to have something else too?
Full disclosure, I have the best spouse on the planet.
Aww.
And I couldn't do any of this without him and without his support. I had 8 weeks to write a draft of Dear Martin. And that ain't a lot of time to write a novel. I basically disappeared from my family for 8 weeks. Oh, so I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, by the way, this is how you balance family and writing. Because I had no balance when I was writing Dear Martin. It was 9 to 10 hours a day. I was holed up in my bedroom. My husband was with my son. And I cranked it out. And I find that, honestly, trying to find balance, I wasted time trying to find balance instead of just working with what I had. I know it's partially a personality thing, but I just write when I can. That's a very important thing. Don't give in to guilt over not being able to write because you have other responsibilities. Like you do what you have to do.
Thank you for saying that, because I feel a lot of our listeners are always struggling with guilt. Either it's not enough time with the kids or not enough time with their work, and they feel they're turning their back on themselves.
Absolutely. We're always going to be failing at something. It's not possible to succeed at everything. Everybody in the whole world, everybody listening to this podcast, cut yourself some slack, please. I really do think if people would try to get in the headspace of, I am doing the best I can with what I have. I operate from that space, because if I don't, I would lose my mind. And I think that it's important to give yourself credit for what you're doing and to be okay with not getting it all done. There are only 24 hours in a day. You will do what you can do with what you can do.
You can do what you can do, what you can do with it.
Yes, do what you can and know that it's okay to fail. Yes. In certain areas, if you're succeeding in other ones. There are days when my children are being babysat by VeggieTales. It's just, it is what it is.
At least it's vegetables.
Right? No, it is. It is what it is.
I get it. And thank you for that. Also, huge props to your hubby. So sweet.
He is everything, man. I love that guy.
I don't mean to pry. I know you met him in Israel. And first of all, why were you in Israel?
Oh, man. This is a fun story. So I basically went to Israel to find myself. You know how, like, when you're super young and you have these ideas about what you're supposed to be doing with your life? I am super lofty headed. My husband is the damn string to my kite. My head is always in the clouds, always. So I go to Israel. I was 22 when I went. I just dropped out of college again, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I was very, very intensely evangelical at this point. I decided I was going to Israel to find myself and find God. That's how I ended up there in the first place. And instead, I found this gorgeous man. And I mean, not to say that I didn't find other things that I was looking for, but I met him randomly one night, and we really hit it off. And then I went back the following summer to go into premarital counseling. We were friends for 5 months. We were not doing that whole long distance relationship thing. Like, I couldn't do it. So we just stayed in the friend zone. We had these hardcore boundaries. This is not romantic sounding at all, but it worked, because when I went back, we went straight into premarital counseling. Marriage for us was very purposeful. It was a practical decision, because it's like, I can't move here to be your girlfriend. You can't move to the United States to be my boyfriend. So either we legally connect ourselves so that we can live in the same place, or this isn't going to work. And so we went into counseling and we got married within like 6 months.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
And 8 years now. You can tell I'm still obsessed. So it was a good call.
You guys are so cute. Stop right now. I just got chills on my back. FYI. That's so freaking cute. That's an amazing way to keep things spicy and fresh too. You're still learning about each other, and it's so much fun.
Yeah, it is. It is fun.
Relationship goals over here. Jokes aside, I'm so happy for you. And as supportive as he is of you and for you, I'm sure you are the same with him. I can just hear it just from the way you talk about him. I love those stories. Thank you for sharing that. Jumping back into your book, can we dive a little bit deeper about research?
Okay.
I know it was inspired by news about what's been happening. Our country's gone to shit. In this world, with everything happening, one of the shootings that inspired you was Jordan Davis.
Yes.
And that was, what, 2012?
Yep, that was 2012.
And also Michael Brown. So can we dive into that more and how that shaped the voice for the book?
Yes. Okay, as I mentioned, I have these two little black boys that I'm raising. I have to teach them how to exist in the world. And you said, you know, our country's gone to shit. I would actually argue that our country's been shit, and it's just coming to the surface now.
Yes, it's coming to light. You're right.
Trayvon Martin really was the impetus, I would say, for this examination that's happening right now in our country, this examination of race relations, an examination of the way people interact. But Jordan Davis was the one that hit me the hardest because all he was doing was listening to his music. He's in this car with his friends in this convenience store parking lot, and this guy in the car next to him decides that he doesn't like the fact that their music is turned up so loud, mm-hmm. and things escalated. That one hit me the hardest. And then Michael Brown hit me because he was killed by a police officer. My father, for the first 24 years of my life, was a police officer. So I grew up with this notion of police officers as heroes. Growing up, I saw a uniform, I felt safe. That was my personal reality because if I saw a uniform, I was reminded of my daddy. Yeah. So for a police officer to kill an unarmed kid, my world just kind of started to crumble at that point. Well, not even my world, my paradigms just kind of started shaking and shifting. There were so many things that I honestly was ignoring that I felt like I needed to look a little bit further into. And like I said, the MLK aspect came in after hearing so many people, from Kasim Reed, the mayor of Atlanta, to Bill O'Reilly, quoting Dr. King in opposition to Black Lives Matter protests. There was a point where the mayor of Atlanta asked protesters not to take any of the highways because Dr. King would never take a freeway. And I was like, but no, because there are pictures of Dr. King on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is part of a freeway. The evidence is there if we're willing to actually look at it. And that's when I realized that, oh, people aren't actually thinking before they say these things. They're not thinking critically about anything and not doing any research. So what I ended up doing was buying this big book. I could plunk somebody over the head with it. And it's basically this compendium of Dr. King's teachings, his sermons, his interviews, just about everything that was ever put to paper. His books are all in there. And I took this thing and I just went through it. It had an index. So if there was something specific, like a specific topic that I wanted to know what Dr. King's opinion was on, like I would just go to the index, look up those quotes. And in the process of doing all of this research, I spent 2 months either sobbing uncontrollably or in a rage, ready to burn the world down. Looking back, going through it, I hated everything. I was a holy terror to be around. But I'm glad that I went through it because even though I actually came out of the process with more questions than answers, I also came out of it with more compassion and more empathy and more understanding of why things function the way they do in our country. It sucks a little bit. There's this James Baldwin quote. I don't want to misquote it, but basically the gist is if you are an African American person living in this country and you have any semblance of consciousness of the world around you, you'll be angry pretty much all the time. And that's very, very true for me. I've learned how to, I won't say rise above it because I don't want to rise above it. I want it to be there continuously burning in my gut. I want this anger to stay with me because it drives me and it pushes me to want to make change and to do my work. It's also a very difficult thing to constantly live with. That's really what the research did for me.
I can't even imagine. I didn't go in depth with the research the way you did, but just from the news, I wake up every day either feeling devastated or an absolute depression. I've been diagnosed with depression. So it's like that on and off, like that cloudiness with all this news and just what's been happening, but it's brought to light now. Special thanks to the technology that's able to capture things in real time from bystanders or like witnesses. So it's really airing out what's been really happening around our country. And I know that you were saying too, you have more questions than answers. I feel the same way. I would love to know if there is anything you do want to share where you think in order to make change, how could we best do it?
What I would say first is that change has to happen internally before it can happen anywhere else. Self-reflection and asking tough questions and actually getting down into the things that make you feel helpless and feel uncomfortable. Doing that is probably the most important thing anybody can do right now. Looking at systemic racism, because I've encountered so many people who basically were in denial of systemic racism's existence until Charlottesville. It's one of those things where I'm like, this has been in our face. Well, it's been in my face my whole life. If people can't ignore it, they will. if you want to make change, first, you need to look inside yourself to make sure that you're coming from a place of, have I made changes inside myself? Have I made sure that I don't have problematic thinking? Have I thought about how I interact with the people around me when I get on an elevator? If a Black guy gets on an elevator, will I clutch my purse? These are the kind of things that people need to stop and just think about. Pick up a book from the civil rights era. Pick up Letter from a Birmingham Jail. That's one of Dr. King's. There's a lady named Lillian Smith. She's actually a white woman, and she was writing on race back before the civil rights movement. And actually, Dr. King, a lot of his teachings drew on her teachings in her books. One of her books is called Killers of the Dream. That is a book. Wow. Also, James Baldwin. Anything by James Baldwin. The Fire Next Time is very small. It's super short. And it's not a quick read because it's very cerebral and it's very thought-provoking. But that's another book. People need to get okay with being uncomfortable and get okay with not having answers. Because honestly, part of our issue is that we don't want to look at stuff we can't find a solution for. It's like, oh, I don't know what the solution is. So I'm
and also a lot of us don't want to talk, have a normal conversation of actually listening.
There's so many taboo. Exactly. So many things are taboo and we're afraid. I think part of the reason we're afraid to talk about them is because we don't have the answers to the problems. Like, we don't know how to fix the problems. But just because you don't know how to fix the problem doesn't mean you should pretend the problem's not there. Getting to a point where we can fix the problem will first involve everybody admitting there is a problem. So self-reflection, I think, is, in my opinion, the biggest thing anybody can do, especially right now. And I also think it's very, very important, and this is going to probably sound like it's coming out of left field, but to find your safe space and to find your happiness, find where you thrive. Because as you were saying, in the world we live in today, I could wake up every day and just not want to get out of bed because there are so many things that are terrible and there are so many things that are devastating and depressing. And even this morning, this shooting in Las Vegas, I can't even tell you. I remember kind of threw me back to Pulse last year because I had a friend who was killed at Pulse at the Pulse Club in Orlando. One of my best friends was killed at Pulse.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry. Like,
yeah. Right. So because of that, I have to do my art. I have to write. I have to do these things that keep me thriving and keep me going and keep me feeling alive. Because if I don't, I won't function. And I say that to everybody else. That's another way that you can actually, believe it or not, that's another way to make change is to thrive. Seeing other people thriving will give people who are not thriving the gusto. Can be inspiring to help other people thrive. Getting to a place where you are being your best self, living your best life, is one of the easiest ways to make change because then people around you want to do the same. Self-reflect, find that zen, that thing that you need, that thing that will help you to function, not only function, but will help you to thrive and will give you a sense of joy and will help you to see good in the world around you because that's also really important. If you can't see good in the world around you, if I can't see good, I'm not going to be able to make good.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, so powerful. Thank you for that. I think just for me, it's like what I definitely needed as a reminder. Are you aware of Brené Brown's work?
Sounds familiar.
Okay, so she was saying, because also everything you listed, I absolutely agree with. And I also, tying it back to your book, because you're so amazing at bringing in a lot of different layers. What really starts everything, the catalyst, is the racial profiling. And then you're able to weave in these microaggressive statements. And also, there's something that I've heard quite a lot, but now people are being a little bit more careful with what they're saying, is like, stop being so sensitive. And like for race related jokes and, you know, whether it's for Asian people or Black people. And if I'm saying that's not cool, it's like, okay, stop being so sensitive. That's something that I've always struggled with. And it sucks, especially if it's coming from friends. I know that I've had that experience before where I'm just like, wait, what? I thought you were supposed to have my back, but now you're saying I'm sensitive or that I might be paranoid. Yeah. I've been literally looking for ways to have a conversation that is productive because I can easily get very heated. I have no problems with confrontation, arguments. I think that's a problem with me is that I will jump too quickly to fight verbally. I need to listen more too, but I get angry because I feel like, why do I need to listen when clearly the other person is the one making really offensive statements? I was looking for ways of dealing with these conversations. I know it sounds cheesy, but truly out of love. I'm trying to come from a compassionate place and empathetic place where, okay, I want that person to understand what I'm going through when they're saying something like that. So Brené Brown, her theory is to never shame. Don't ever be like, you are an idiot, da 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 da. Or if you don't want someone calling someone something, like you can't call that person that same word too. To also approach it as in like very calmly, that really, really upsets me or that hurts me. So I'm just like, these are like different ways of approaching conversations like that. And I'm wondering what is your personal take, and if you've ever been in that situation, and if you've come out of that situation where you were able to talk to somebody else and feel it was a productive conversation where it did change something in them.
Yeah. Yeah. I am going to disagree with Brené a little bit. This partially comes from the fact that Brené is a white woman. So I can't approach things the same way that she can. And I know people are going to be like, oh, there she goes with the race card. But like, it's true.
No, no, no.
You know?
It's true.
Sometimes you do have to pop off. You do have to let people know that they're being a dick. And I think that that's a very important thing, because shame, honestly, if you think about it, shame is how nonviolent protest brings change. We'll do it for instance. Let's take Charlottesville. Nobody was really saying anything too intensely about Charlottesville until homeboy drove his car into that crowd. That's when everybody was like, oh, wow, maybe we do have a problem. That's what nonviolent protest does. It brings out people's ugliness, and then the people who are watching, then those consciences are tweaked. So shame is actually very powerful. I do think it's important. Rhetoric is very important, though, is the thing. Because, yeah, I have had conversations. For instance, recently I was having a conversation with a friend about adoption, and they were talking about a white friend of theirs who is interested in adopting an African-American boy. That's great. It's beautiful. But when my friend was, she really just wants to save him. And that is evidence of very problematic thinking. The difference between white saviorism and white allyship has to do with focus. If you are going to be an ally, your focus should be on the problem, not on the person. I don't need you to feel sorry for me. Mm-hmm. I need you to recognize that systemic racism is an issue. And to focus on that. Don't focus on helping me. I don't need you to focus on helping me. If it's in your mind that you're going to help people of color, you're going to help Black people get ahead, you're probably...
There's an issue with them. Like, they need to fix themselves first.
Right, right. There's also, even just the idea of feeling like you're in a position to help somebody, there's a chance you haven't checked your privilege. It's one thing to use your privilege to speak to other people who are privileged like you.
Yes.
To break systems down that are oppressing other people. It's another thing entirely to say, okay, you, my Black friend, how can I help you? I understand good intentions. Good intentions are beautiful, but the road to hell really and truly is paved with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when it comes to interacting with friends who have problematic ways of thinking, who say really shitty things, I am all about being like, listen, if we're really friends, you're going to listen to what I'm saying, because if you're not listening, then we're probably not as good of friends as I think we are. You are my friend. Let me ask you some questions. That's another big thing, is leading with questions. Why do you think this? What makes you think that this joke would not be offensive? Do you care about offending someone? Does it not bother you that you might be hurting someone? These kind of questions, I think, are, they're shaming, honestly, but they're also a way that shames.
It's awakening, though, for them.
Right. It's the onus on them to examine themselves, hopefully.
Yes, thank you. Nick, you are just so freaking solid. You are amazing, and the world needs way more of you, and I am so excited. You better be writing more books.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, as soon as I get off of here with you, I got to go do these copy edits for book two.
Amazing.
Book two.
Wait, excuse me. Are you allowed to share anything or no?
All I can really say at this point, the information will be out there soon enough. There's already a cover. There's like, it's very, very exciting having all of these secret things going on before the first book is even out.
You're killing
me over
here.
But I can say that it deals with a different marginalized aspect of my identity. And it's a different book, I will say that. But hopefully, it does the same question-raising thing that people tell me Dear Martin has done for them. I have a lot of people that come to me and they say, wow, this book had me asking questions that, like, I never really thought about before. And the goal is for this next book to do the same thing, but about a different topic. And it's fun. It's written as kind of a trilogy of novellas. So, Each, there's three protagonists, and each one has their own book within the book. It's fun.
Do you have approximate date?
Right now, it's slated for next fall, around this time.
Are you stressing out?
No. Oh my gosh, no. I'm excited. This is the thing. When you're working, I find that for myself, in order for me to not freak out about what's happening now, I have to be doing other things. And so I am just thrilled that I already have a second book that's in the pipeline. It means the world to me that I'm not going to be a one shot off. If this book doesn't hit, cool, that's fine. I've got another book coming out next year, and I'll have another one coming out the year after that. Being career-minded about writing has been very helpful, so I'm excited. Like, I'm glad I have all of this work to do.
I'm excited for you. I think that's incredible, and I'm so excited for you, and I cannot wait to look out for that. Was that something that you shared a proposal to your agent, and they're like, this is amazing, let's go? Or how does that work?
Well, for me, my experience has been very atypical, but when I got the call from the editor about the proposal for Dear Martin, she asked me if I had any other ideas, and I literally just threw something out there.
What?
And yeah,
I did. You and your pulling out stuff out of thin air magic.
I had this idea spinning in my head. I write fiction to examine norms for the most part, because I don't like norms that go unexamined. So, for instance, with Dear Martin, it's the racial status quo is really what I'm examining in that book.
Yeah.
In my next book, what I'm examining is heteronormativity, because I don't like it. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, people make assumptions about me because my husband is a dude, you know.
Oh, I think I'm going to love this one, too.
It gets pretty deep. And I'm excited about it because, really, when I was chewing on it, almost 3 years ago, when it just kind of popped into my head, what I wanted to do was examine what would it be like if the norms in your house are the opposite of the norms in the world? How would that affect how you see yourself from a very young age, right?
Yes.
So that's what I'm kind of exploring in this second book. And I threw out this sentence, right? I'm like, well, I kind of been thinking about this thing where this person has this thing, and then, like, then this other person is here, and she was just like, oh, I love it. And so while I was waiting, while I was waiting for my edits on Dear Martin, I get antsy when I'm just waiting. So I just decided to write this. I just wrote it. I was like, okay, well, I need something to do. Let me just write this book that I pitched. And it's always a risk when you're doing that, because the editor could be like, nah. True story, she did do that with Dear Martin. The first version of Dear Martin, it was 80,000 words. It was double the length. It was 8 points of view, and it was nonlinear. And she got it, and she was like, nah, we got to simplify this. You have now, it's literally the second version of Dear Martin.
So you literally wrote two books for this one book. Yeah. Glad you expanded on that, because I was like, oh, hell no. How did she not like this? I'm glad you expanded into details.
We both do. I'm so
You're
happy.
You're happy with the changes.
Oh, I love it. My editor is kind of a legend. She really is. She edited Walter Dean Myers for 20
years. Damn! Okay, all right. I'm stepping off. Okay, done.
Right, exactly. I'm like, I'm going to let you be great, Phoebe, because you clearly already are. So let me just take your advice, because you know what you're doing. She was really into the second book, and it was a relief, I'll say.
What was that like? I mean, I'm assuming she's coming in slashing left and right.
Oh, man. She is brutal.
I mean,
like, in the best way possible. But yo, when I send her something, I know that I'm going to get it back. It's going to be trash.
It's like butcher knife went through it.
Basically. And she's super old school. So my editor, she edits on paper. So she'll print out the manuscript and she'll write in her handwriting. She'll, like, write notes and stuff she likes. There'll be exclamation points by it. And then on the side, there'll be these backhanded shade. Like, she'll throw everything. For instance, on this most recent manuscript, there was a note that was, this is kind of corny, with a question mark.
Oh, my God. Oh, she tells it like it is. Is she a New Yorker?
Oh, totally. She's a Chinese American lady.
My people! Yes, she sounds like my mom.
She does not mess around at all. So I'll get these little comments and I'm like, okay. I remember these blocks of text. Like in Dear Martin, there was one that was this big X across the whole page. And on the side, it said, why is this here? Oh.
She sounds like my piano
She's
teacher.
A boss.
That's how I was raised with my mom. My mom goes a big X over my life choices. She's like, who are you? What is this? I just want you to understand what I grew up with was basically your editor my whole life.
So you feel me.
Like I feel you all the time.
So she'll go through and then she'll put the manuscript with her notes on it on a scanner and email me a PDF of scanned pages. So then I go through and make changes. Then we go back and forth like that. And then additionally, I'll get an email that's macro notes. So it'll be between 6 and 12 pages of things that need to be fixed on the story level. And this particular character is creepy. I got that one on this last page. She's like, so either make him less creepy or take him out, things like that. So we go back and forth on things toward the end. Like I go to copy edits and then I get from her, I get copy edits. And then after copy edits, I get line edits from her where she's still kind of, okay, on page 32, this line, I don't really know about this. On page 15, da-da. And so then I have to go back through again between copy edits and when it goes to print completely. Because even in ARC, we were still making changes. My first ARCs went out in, like, January, and we were still going through and fixing things.
She's a blessing to have that
absolutely.
Kind of honesty, but also not just honesty though. Like she actually has a vision too, because there's a lot
she
of people
does.
Who can be honest, like just throwing shit out of their mouths and they don't even know what they're saying. There's like no structure, nothing, but she has a vision plus honesty is just an absolute weapon that any writer can have on her team. I'm in love with this woman after you're telling me about her.
She's the queen. It can be very hard, but she's my book mom. Rarely am I, I push back sometimes, but very, very rarely because she knows what she's doing, you know? And that's something very important that I'm going to say to writers who are looking to publish traditionally.
Yes.
If you can't trust your editor, you got a problem. It's generally on the writer because the writer, we got a lot of hubris and we'd be like, but this is my story and I know best. And I don't want to change this particular scene. But I'm like, your editor is an editor for a reason. There's a lot of give and take and collaboration that happens.
And
like,
set
you
that
know,
ego down.
Back.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. There are places where you're going to have to push back. But in general, and you can kind of get a feel, any person who is like on sub right now, I'm going to say this to y'all. When you talk to these editors, make sure you ask them what their vision is for your novel. Because if you don't agree with it, you don't want them as your editor. You're going to butt heads constantly.
I'm assuming that your agent introduced you to multiple different editors for you to interview them.
You only talk to an editor when they want to make an offer. So this is really only for people whose books are going to go to auction. If your book goes to auction, you're going to talk to these different editors. And when you're talking to them, of course, there's this temptation to just want to like take the biggest pot of money. But you just got to think about it like, okay, maybe the biggest pot of money doesn't align with your personal vision for your book. If it doesn't,
okay.
It's something to take into consideration. If you talk to different editors and one is, your book is about a skateboarding kid who loses his left toe and has to learn how to skate again, but I think we should make it about race relations. Like, you might not want to go with that editor. You see what I'm saying?
So it's not so much about you pushing and convincing them to see your vision.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So then you let them do the talking and you're listening and seeing like, all right, does this fit? Does this not? Do I like the direction? And no.
Because if they're ready to make an offer, they have something in mind.
That is so, oh my God, what a freaking process. I also want to know when your editor first, just you need to slash basically half of your book. Do you remember the day that she told you this? And what do you do right after?
I know it was July 2015. It was a phone call. And we were on the phone for 2.5 hours. I was like, hell to the no. By the time that call ended, I was like, okay, yeah, we'll talk later. And then she called me the next day because she was like, okay, no, but you're not listening to me. So we had another 2.5 hour phone call the next day. So it took this woman 5 hours of her being like, you need to listen to me. I know what I'm talking about. I've been doing this for a long time. I have all of these things. Look at my wall. Look at these books. Are you going to trust me or not. I only had 8 weeks to do it.
Yeah.
So the fact that I did it and I cranked it out and I worked my ass off to do it, I wasn't really happy about the idea that I was going to have to do it again.
I know that she's done so much and she's an incredible editor. She's got, like she mentioned, like her wall of accolades. Do you remember if there was something specifically, a sentence that just freaking clicked?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. What did it for me was her saying, Nick, the people you are trying to reach with this book are not going to read it. And she was dead right. I wrote this book for 14 to 18 year old African American boys. The way the book was written before, they wouldn't have touched it. It was too long, for one thing. I'm talking like reluctant readers, people who just aren't interested in reading because, first of all, they don't really see themselves. I don't want to read the book, this book about this white girl who falls in love over the summer in Chesapeake Bay. Like, this is not something I'm interested in, you know? Like, these are the kids I'm writing for are the kids who don't have a lot of people writing for them.
Yes.
And her being, they're not going to read this. It was my light bulb. So I was like, okay, fine, you're right. I have to cut it in half. She said it so quietly. She has this thing where she'll lower her voice like a mom. Yes. And she just said it so quietly. And I was like, well, damn. But that's also why it's written the way it's written. It's not a typical prose novel. You have chunks of it in letters. You have chunks that are in pure dialogue. There are news reports in there. There are newspaper articles.
FYI, I love that. I love things that will keep me on my toes, and I love information packed and back to back, get to the core and the point. I love the way you inserted the news announcements too. I thought that was brilliant.
I wrote the book the way that I wrote it because it's a book for people with short attention spans. Most reluctant readers are reluctant readers because they just can't stay focused for long periods of time, you know? After a while, it's like, oh, I'm not even paying attention anymore. So changing things up, we have this 3-page chapter of prose and then a 3-page letter in a completely different font. And then we have 6 pages of pure dialogue. There are no tags. There are no he said, she said, no her eyebrow quirked up. Like,
yes,
none of that's
I love
there.
That because it read like a script.
Exactly. Yes. And it's written like a script on purpose because it's a way to hold people's attention. Some of the critiques I've gotten from avid readers are that it's too short and that they didn't like the changes in format. And I'm like, yeah, that's because you read big, thick, heavy books. So it doesn't surprise me that this one really didn't appeal to you as much. Number one, it's very short. So if you like long books and you want to like immerse yourself in words, frankly, this ain't the book for you. It is with regard to information, but if you're looking to roll around in lush prose, this isn't going to be the book that you can do that with. If you're looking for this long, drawn-out story, you're not going to get that either because it changes up.
My girlfriend is also an avid reader. She loves Murakami's works. She reads a lot. Really, really big, fat books. And she freaking loved your book. So those avid readers need to get it checked.
Well, thank you. I also just really like playing with form. Like I said, the second book is written as a trilogy of novellas.
Yes.
And this is real talk. Like, I don't know that I'm capable of just writing a straightforward novel. I tried.
I think you are, but you get bored.
I get so bored. My third book is written, and I tried to do it as like a straightforward novel, and I ended up going back and adding footnotes because I was like, this is the most boring thing I've ever read in my life.
That is so funny. I mean, you are obviously so capable of writing like a full-on novel. I feel your brain moves so quickly and you think super fast. You want things to be more exciting. It is such a fantastic read, and honestly, because it's so information-packed and so quick, I think it's an even more powerful required reading for schools. I think so many more students would actually read through it and not BS their way and be like, oh yeah, I read this. And then like, you know, pull up sparknotes.com, which is what I used to do. I loved the main character. Okay. Justice is incredible. Dr. Jarius Dre.
Yeah.
I love what you did with him. And it's so incredible to have such amazing role models that you can look up to. This is something I was talking about with our listeners, and they know this show called The Bold Type. It's on Freeform, and it's about these young women working in the magazine world, and they have a role model, the person in charge of the magazine, who really cares about shaping these young women. And I was talking to Moonlin about it, saying like, you know, they need more of these people that could be seen as positive mentors. And then when I saw it in your book afterwards, we'll call him Doc.
Doc, yeah.
I feel he was very exemplary of Dr. Martin Luther. That was kind of what I saw. I love SG's character. I know that she's Jewish American, so I'm wondering, did you pull any of her characteristics from new friends or any best friends that you met in Israel?
Well, okay, another secret. SJ is totally me. I just made her white because if she had been black, white readers wouldn't really listen to what she had to say. And the conversations in the classroom would have gone a completely different way. So this is me being sneaky. I will say, SJ is heavily influenced by Jodi Picoult, the author. She's one of my mentors.
Oh, and my, what?
I don't know if a lot of people know that she's Jewish, but she is. She had a book come out last year, Small Great Things. And I had the privilege of working with her on that book because it has an African-American protagonist. One of the three protagonists is an African-American woman. And so, like, I got to do the, quote, sensitivity parts.
Like, oh, I was going to say, that's like
I did a lot of the reading. Yeah. And, yeah, I was a sensitivity reader, and I did a lot of the – helped her with a lot of the research. SJ has some Jodi in her, but really she's just me. And me putting my thoughts and what I would say in the classroom into this white girl's mouth so that – people would actually listen to her, as terrible as that sounds. But I mean, the truth of the matter is, as human beings, we find it easier to listen to people we can identify with.
Yes.
So because I want white readers to read this book and actually digest some of the stuff SJ saying, I made her look like them.
You are so brilliant. The geography of Atlanta, I almost felt like it was its own character, just the way it almost is reminiscent of Los Angeles, because I'm from New York and I moved out to LA, and then you would be walking and it's like a suburb and all of a sudden it's not a suburb. And I'm like, wait, what's going on? In New York, at least from Long Island, it's a lot more, you can see it's root. I know that you did grow up in Atlanta.
I did grow up in Atlanta. It was pretty deliberate. And I honestly learned this from a professor at Spelman, because I went to Spelman College. Whoop, whoop. It is Wonderland, by the way. One of my professors at Spelman was talked to me about, because I did an independent study with her in fiction. And we did a lot of talking about setting and how setting should be personified a bit. Like, it should kind of have its own life on the page. And the thing about Atlanta, it's not segregated, but it is. So, like, and what I mean by that is you have, it's very socioeconomically diverse. So it's not necessarily segregated by race. It's more segregated by SES, by socioeconomic status. That ends up kind of being about race because, you know, in general, you're going to have more white people in the places that are richer and more people of color in the places that are more impoverished. So I live in the hood and I love it. My son, though, goes to school in, it's called Buckhead. It's okay. This little neighborhood within the city, and it is the richest part of the city. Buckhead is definitely like the richest part of Atlanta. So every day I drive from my hood 15 minutes, that's it, 15 minutes to go into Buckhead to take my son to school. And there's a bridge that you cross under, and you know when you cross under this bridge that you have entered a different part of the city. I wanted to kind of dig into that a little bit and the influence, how environment influences experience. There's an anthology coming out next year with Balzer and Bray. It's called Black Box. And I have a short story in there where I do the same thing. What I did in this story is I take a girl who lives in the gated community in the richer part of the city, and her mom has a sister who lives in the hood, but this girl has this very skewed understanding of what, quote, living in the hood, what that means and what people there are like and what actually goes on there. And it has come from her mother, who has a lot of internalized depression. Basically, it's her leaving her gated community and going to explore this other part of the city that she's been told is this horrible, horrible place, and kind of coming to discover, spoiler alert, that, like, hey, we're not really that different. The people who live over here and the people who live in my area, most of the people in my area are white. But when it comes to me, I have more in common with the people over here that my mama telling me to stay away from than I do with the people next door. And all of that has to do with location. Atlanta is just the best place to me. I love it so much. Part of the reason I love it so much is because you have these suburban-esque neighborhoods smack in the middle of the city. So 5 seconds from here, we have downtown, but right now I'm in my house with my backyard where there's a pool.
Sort of bits of LA, like, definitely expose me to that geography
more. Right. Yeah,
I'm so sure. I'm just, like, I'm trying to imagine that.
Yeah. So having that environment with the proximity to these places that are lower income, it's a very mishmash type of place. You could grow up 5 minutes from someone and have a wholly and completely different experience.
You're so vivid the way you were able to weave that into the story and just make it the main placeholder. Do you mind if I can move on to the listener questions? I'll only
please,
pick a few.
Please, by all means. I love talking, Yin. I love it.
Oh
so
my God,
please.
Amazing. I'm looking through the questions. We've already covered a lot of it. A lot of them were saying that they've been wanting to read this and they're so excited to get their hands on your book. So just know that. Catherine Fraser asked, saying she'd love to hear about your research process, especially with contemporary fiction. You're really great at creating emotionally resonant work. And she'd love to hear about that piece of it, if that's okay. And for those who've read it, what you could say about how you make it emotionally resonant would be so interesting.
So when I was a senior in high school, I took AP Language and Composition. That was the course that was based on like rhetoric. And it was focused more on writing than it was on literature and reading. So our teacher at one point said, write like a reader and read like a writer. And that has stuck with me for since I heard it. With regard to tapping into emotions and kind of making sure you're getting some emotional resonance on the page, you got to just write as if you're reading, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like the way you want to feel when you're reading, or the way you want your reader to feel, is how you should feel when you're writing it. So if you find that you're writing a scene and, you know, somebody's dying in this scene and you're deadpan about it, it's probably not going to read very emotionally resonantly. I just made that word up. But sometimes as writers, the key to emotional resonance is vulnerability, honestly. Letting yourself feel what you're writing. I sobbed through writing a good chunk of that book. If you drag your characters through hell, you should feel terrible. Like, this is something that you should, and if you don't feel terrible, your readers are not really, probably not going to feel any emotion. And I don't even know if it's like a, if it's something that you can articulate. If I'm feeling it, it shows up on the page.
It's like an expanded version of treat people how you want to be treated. So I do have one I do think is a great question overall. So it's by Maritza Mulit. I hope I pronounced her last name correctly. She said, hi, I'd like to know about the reception people have had about Dear Martin, and also how committed do you think the publishing industry is about making sure diverse stories in general are being told long-term? I really like that question.
I will be honest, I don't really read reviews. I take all quote buzz with a grain of salt. Honestly, I like keeping my expectations low. I feel like it's just a good position to take when you're moving through an industry where everything is so unpredictable. October 17th is going to come and I have no clue what's going to happen. So I have just kind of set myself up to expect nothing to happen. Because in that way, if things, great things happen, I can be like, oh, well, that's nice. That's lovely. I do think that the industry is committed to diversity long term. And I say that because there have been people in the industry who have been trying to get diversity out there for a long time. My editor is one of them. You got Donna Bray at Balzer, Donna and Alessandra at Balzer and Bray. There are people who are doing the work and have been doing the work since way before 2014 when the diverse books movement really kicked off. So I do think it's slow, because there does need to be some change when it comes to gatekeepers. We need people of color in marketing, in publicity, in sales. We need to diversify the publishing industry as a whole. But I do think it is going in a positive direction. And I do think that trajectory will continue. And like, it will get to a point where diverse books are just as, I hope it will get to a point where diverse books are just as numerous and mainstream as books that are lily white.
Why do we think that publicists and like the publishing world, why is it primarily white?
It's an excellent question. I don't really know. I have the same question. I mean, I do wonder if it has something to do with the fact that because it's always been so white, it's not attractive to people who aren't white.
Is it possible that we think that it's because it's primarily white, why even try?
Yeah, potentially. That's okay. That could be part of it. Okay. And I also think, you know, it's all related. So not having diverse books means people of diverse persuasions aren't really interested in the books that are out there, which means they aren't interested in the book industry. That's all. That's very, very generalized. I do think that it's all connected. If I'm not seeing myself in a book, why would I think I would see myself in a room with a, in a marketing room? It wouldn't even cross my mind. If I can't see myself as an author, I'm definitely not going to see myself as an editor.
I do think it's so important to be inclusive, but I think for me as a writer, what I'm working on is very specific to my own experiences, and I feel I would lean more towards an editor who would be your editor, Chinese American, for example.
Yeah, because I feel an editor like of color, absolutely.
Understand more than someone who believes that Asian culture or Asian American culture should be a certain way. Didn't even hit me till you mentioned that your editor is Asian American, and I was like, whoa, that's awesome.
It is really awesome, you know, let me just tell you.
Those possibilities, like, not everybody's like this, but I do feel they'll fight harder for your larger vision
does.
And can shape it in a way where it sees beyond sometimes what we're hoping for in a larger and even more impactful way. Because maybe it's something that they were wishing that could be out there, or like wishing that they had a chance to read for themselves growing up. Going back, you were saying you got an email. I'm curious about
this. Oh, yeah. See, I'm so glad you reminded me because I completely...
I feel like we're reminding each other about things.
This is collaboration. I presented at the Southern Independent Bookseller Alliance, their annual conference in New Orleans a few weeks ago. I was one of four authors at this breakfast, and the other three authors were white men. I get up there, right? I had to go after Brendan Reichs, who is freaking hilarious, and he basically spent 10 minutes making everybody laugh. So then I get up there, and I'm like, oh, by the way, Debbie Downer right here. We're going to get real for a second. And so the first thing I said was, oh, yeah, I'm like the only non-white person in this room. No, actually, I think I said, am I the only brown person in this room? And there was literally one other lady in this room of 150 people who raised her hand. And I just kind of took that and ran with it and talked about what some of the stuff I was saying earlier about discomfort and being willing to ask difficult questions and like why I wrote Dear Martin. And, you know, I'm basically up there trying to pitch the book in a different way than I've been pitching it because it gets a little repetitive. Anyway, I get an email a week later from this man who said that he was at that breakfast and that the stuff that I was saying did something for him. And so he decided to read my book first out of all of the books he picked up. He was thanking me for shifting his perspective. So he's like, I'm 73.
Oh, what? Grew
up in middle of nowhere, Michigan. And this book has really made me think about some stuff that I've never considered before. And I just wanted to thank you and tell you that I'm passing it on. 15-year-old granddaughter. What you were saying about like this whole reaching across ages and across demographics, that email is one of my favorites I've gotten so far.
An incredible email.
That's one I'm going to hang up at some point. It's going to be on the wall.
Congratulations. You're making a serious real-world change. You're making a movement. You approach each character with empathy. There were characters where in real life, you would easily want to dismiss them and be like, dude, get the hell out of my face. You added empathy and showed us depth. You basically added explanation as to what led them to how they are now in the book and why, and then also redemption and owning up. I just loved it.
This is one of those areas where I am right, where Brené Brown and I were like, we see eye to eye on this thing. Because I really think it was important for me because I know some Jareds. He didn't come out of my imagination. He was the easiest character to write because I know so many. But I felt it important that he be allowed to say his piece. That way, people who think like he does, they can see themselves. They can see, okay, well, this is my perspective, and it's being presented respectfully, and then it's respectfully taken down. The whole point in that is so that people are allowed to see themselves wherever they are right now. Yes. I don't want this to just be a book for people who are already woke. This is also a book for people who maybe aren't woke and don't really want to be woke, but they're going to pick it up because somebody will give it to them, and they'll start reading, and they'll be like, oh, okay, maybe I should think about that a little bit.
Maybe I should check myself. Like you said in the beginning, self-reflect.
Right. And I mean, is the book not the perfect place to do this kind of thing? I had a question on an interview a few days ago where basically the interviewer was asking me, what do you have to say to people who would be afraid to pick up a book like yours because they fear that it's going to be angry? Honestly, what better place to confront someone else's anger than a book?
Exactly.
It can't punch you. It can't hurt you. It's the perfect place into somebody else's head, get into somebody else's emotions, because you have the space in a book with a book to actually chew on things without having to respond.
Yes, exactly. You wrote with compassion on such a difficult conversation. It's been happening, like you said. It's now being brought to light. And right now, people, I feel like, because it's being brought to light, are more aware of these conversations we need to have than before. You bang this out in 8 weeks and then having to scrap half of it and do it again. I took that. Nick Stone, you have been wonderful. And thank you for spending way over an hour with us. I'm so happy we had a chance to connect and have a really nice conversation.
Thank you for having me.
And if there's anything you want to share to wrap it up, say to our listeners, your platform, your time.
Yeah, I am on... Damn, what platforms am I on?
I know you're on Twitter and Instagram.
Instagram and Twitter, both at GetNicked, GetNicced. And the website is nickstone.info.
Thank you so much. I cannot wait to release your episode.
And that wraps up our episode with Nick Stone. Nick, I loved our discussion and I'm so happy we had the chance to talk. Storytellers, thank you so much for listening in. Please say hi to Nick on Twitter at GetNicked. And that's two C's. For the books and resources mentioned in her episode, as well as the exclusive excerpt of Dear Martin, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Nick-Stone. If you enjoyed Nick's episode, or if it helped you in any way, I would love to ask you for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leave a rating and a review. Producing a podcast takes a lot of time, and we put a lot of heart and soul into making 88 Cups of Tea the best that it can be. When you take those specific actions of subscribing, leaving a rating, and a review, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before, and we're really trying to get the word out about our podcast. Thank you so much for helping us grow our community. Don't forget to join our private Facebook group if you want to hang out with fellow writers and fellow listeners from 88 Cups of Tea. I'm so excited to see you in there. You can find us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week and I'll catch you next Thursday.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.